Look to Windward, Cassette 7.
A terrible, terrible thought has just occurred to me.
What would that be?
The first night of expiring light.
Ah, you have a title for your new work.
Yes.
I'll let the relevant people know. As well as the meteorite showers I mentioned earlier, we'll have a conventional laser and firework show, plus there will be troop dancing and a holler image interpretation.
Yes, yes, I'm sure my music will provide suitable oral wallpaper for all this spectacle.
Zilla, I hope you know it will all be done with exquisite taste. It will all fade for the end when the second nova ignites.
That's not what I'm worried about. I'm sure it will all go splendidly.
Then what?
You're going to invite that son of a prey bitch Quillen, aren't you?
Ah.
Yes. Ah. You are, aren't you? I knew it. I can just feel the tumorous pus brain circling in. I should never have said he could move to Akeem. Don't know what I was thinking of.
I think it would be very bad form not to invite Emissary Quillen. The concert will probably be the single most important cultural event on the whole orbital this year.
What do you mean, probably?
All right, definitely. There has been a vast amount of interest. Even using the Stallion Bowl, the number of people who are going to have to be disappointed in the matter of live tickets is going to be immense. I've had to run competitions to make sure your keenest fans are there, and then randomize almost all the rest of the distribution. There's a good chance that nobody from the board will be able to make it to the event live, unless some ingratiate gives up their seat. The transmit audience over the whole O could be 10 billion or more. I personally have exactly 3 tickets at my disposal. The allocation is so tight, I'll have to use one if I want one of my own avatars to attend.
So, a perfect excuse for not inviting this Quillen character.
You and he are the only 2 Chelgrians here, Zilla. You composed it, and he's our honored guest. How can I not invite him?
Because I won't go if he does, that's why.
You mean you won't attend your own first night?
Correct.
You won't conduct?
That's right.
But you always conduct the first night's performance.
Not this time.
Not if he's going to be there.
But you have to be there.
No, I don't.
But who'll conduct it?
Nobody.
These things don't really need conducting. Composers conduct to feed their own ego and to feel part of the performance rather than just the preparation.
That's not what you said before. You said there were nuances that could not be programmed. Decisions that a conductor could make at the time, on the night, in response to the audience's ongoing reactions, which required a single individual to collate, analyze, and react to, functioning as a focal point for the distributed...
I was bullshitting you.
You seemed as sincere then as you do now.
It's a gift. The point is, I won't conduct if this mercenary whore boy is there. I won't be anywhere near the place. I'll be at home, or somewhere else.
That would be very embarrassing for all concerned.
So keep him away if you want me there.
How could I possibly do that?
You are a hub mind, as you've recently explained in exhausting detail. Your resources are almost infinite.
Why can't we just keep the 2 of you apart on the night?
Because it won't happen.
An excuse will be found to bring us together. An encounter will be manufactured. What if I give you my word that I will make sure that Quillen and you are never brought face to face? He will be there, but I'll ensure that you are kept apart.
With one avatar?
Have you put a sound field round us?
Just round our heads, yes.
This avatar's lips will no longer move, and its voice will alter slightly as a result. Don't be alarmed.
I'll try to hold my terror in check. Go on.
If I really have to, I can make sure there are several avatars there at the concert. They don't always have to have silver skin, you know. And I'll have drones present, too.
Big, bulky drones?
Better. Small, mean ones.
No good. No deal.
And knife missiles?
Still no.
Why not? I do hope you are not going to say that you don't trust me. My word is my word. I never break it.
I do trust you.
The reason that it's no deal is because of the people who would want this meeting to happen. Go on.
Tersono. Contact. Grief. Special fucking circumstances, for all I know. If they want the two of us to meet, I mean really, determinedly want, could you definitely, certainly stop it from happening, Hub?
Your question could apply to any moment since Quillen's arrival.
Yes, but until now, a seemingly chance meeting would have been too artificial, too obviously contrived. They'd have expected me to react badly, and they'd have been absolutely right. Our meeting must look like fate, like it was inevitable, as though my music, my talent, my personality, and very being have made it preordained.
You could always go, and if you're forced to meet, still react badly.
No. I don't see why I should. I don't want to meet him, simple as that.
I give you my word I will do everything I can to make sure that you do not meet.
Answer the question.
If SC were determined to force a meeting, could you stop them?
No.
As I thought. I'm not doing very well here, am I?
No.
However, there is one thing that might change my mind.
Ah,
what's that?
Look into the bastard's mind.
I can't do that, Zilla.
Why not?
It is one of the very few more or less unbreakable rules of the culture. Nearly a law. If we had laws, it would be one of the first on the statute book.
Only more or less unbreakable?
It is done very, very rarely, and the result tends to be ostracism. There was a ship called the Grey Area once. It used to do that sort of thing. It became known as the Meat Fucker as a result. When you look up the catalogues, that's the name it's listed under, with its original chosen name as a footnote. To be denied your self-designated name is a unique insult in the culture, Zilla. The vessel disappeared some time ago. Probably it killed itself, arguably as a result of the shame attached to such behaviour and resulting disrespect.
All it is looking inside an animal brain.
That's just it. It's so easy. And it would mean so little, really. That is why the not doing of it is probably the most profound manner in which we honour our biological progenitors. This prohibition is a mark of our respect, and so I cannot do it.
You mean you won't do it?
They are almost the same thing.
You have the ability?
Of course.
Then do it.
Why?
Because I won't attend the concert otherwise.
I know that. I mean, what would I be looking for?
The real reason he's here.
You really imagine he might be here to harm you?
It's a possibility.
What would stop me saying I would do this thing and then only pretending to do it? I could tell you I had looked and found nothing.
I'd ask you to give your word you would really do it.
Have you not heard of the idea that a promise made under duress does not count?
Yes. You know you could have said nothing there.
I wouldn't want to deceive you, Zilla. That, too, would be dishonourable.
Then it sounds like I'm not going to that concert.
I will still hope that you might, and work towards it.
Never mind. You could always hold another competition. The winner gets to conduct.
Let me think about this. I'll release the sound field. Let's watch the Dune Riders. The Avatar and the Chelrian turned from facing each other to stand with the others by the parapet of the trundling feast hall's viewing platform. It was night, and cloudy, Knowing the weather would be so, people had come to the dune slides of Aphilivis Regniunt to watch the biolume boarding. The dunes were not normal dunes. They were titanic spills of sand forming a 3-kilometer-high slope from one plate to another, marking where the sands from one of the great river's sandbank spurnings were blown across towards the plate's spinward edge to slip down to the desert regions of the sunken continent below. People ran, rolled, boarded, skied, skiffed, or boated down the dunes all the time, but on a dark night, there was something special to be seen. Tiny creatures lived in the sands, arid cousins of the plankton that created bioluminescence at sea, and when it was very dark, you could see the tracks left by people as they tumbled, twisted, or carved their way down the vast slope. It had become a tradition that on such nights, the force of individuals pleasing only themselves and the occasional watching admirer was turned into something more organized. And so, once it was dark enough and sufficient numbers of spectators had turned up on the crawler-mounted viewing platforms, bars, and restaurants, teams of boarders and skiers set off from the top of the dunes in choreographed waves, triggering sand-slip cascades in broad lines and Vs of scintillating light, descending like slow, ghostly surf, and weaving gently sparkling trails of soft blue, green, and crimson tracks across the sighing sands, myriad necklaces of enchanted dust glowing like linear galaxies in the night. Zilla watched for a while. Then he sighed and said, "He's here, isn't he?"
"A kilometer away," the Avatar replied. "Higher up, on the other side of the run. I'm monitoring the situation. Another one of me is with him. You are quite safe."
"This is as close as I ever want to get to him, unless you can do something."
"I understand."
Chapter 12, A Defeat of Echoes.
So unterritorial.
I suppose when you have this much territory, you can afford to be.
Do you think I'm old-fashioned to be disturbed by it?
No, I think it's quite natural.
They have too much of everything.
With the possible exception of suspicion.
We can't be sure of that.
I know. Still, so far so good.
Quillan closed the lockless door to his apartment. He turned and looked out at the floor of the gallery, 30 meters below. Groups of humans strolled amongst the plants and pools, between the stalls and bars, the restaurants and, well, shops, exhibitions. It was hard to know what to call them. The apartment they had given him was near the roof level of one of Akeem City's central galleries. One set of rooms looked out across the city to the inland sea. The other side of the suite, like this glazed lobby outside, looked down into the gallery itself. Akeem's altitude, and consequently cold winters, meant that a lot of the life of the city took place indoors rather than out, and as a result, what would have been ordinary streets in a more temperate city, open to the sky, here were galleries, roofed-over streets vaulted with anything from antique glass to force fields. It was possible to walk from one end of the city to the other, undercover and wearing summer clothes, even when, as now, there was a blizzard blowing. Free of the driving snow that was bringing visibility down to a few meters, the view from the apartment's exterior was delicately impressive. The city had been built in a deliberately archaic style, mostly from stone. The buildings were red and blonde and grey and pink, and the slates covering the steeply pitched roofs were various shades of green and blue. Long, tapering fingers of forest penetrated the city almost to its heart, bringing further greens and blues into play, and, with the galleries, dicing the city into irregular blocks and shapes. A few kilometres in the distance, the docks and canals would glitter under a morning sun. Spinward of those, On a gentle slope of ridge rising to the outskirts of the city, Quillan could, when it was clear, see the tall buttresses and towers of the ornately decorated apartment building which contained the home of Marai Zilla.
So, could we just go and walk into his apartment?
No. He got somebody to make him locks when he heard I was coming. Apparently this was mildly scandalous.
Well, we could have locks too.
I think it better not to, thought you might. We wouldn't want it to look like I have something to hide.
That would never do.
Quillan swung open a window, letting the sounds of the gallery into the apartment. He heard tinkling water, people talking and laughing, birdsong and music. He watched drones and people in float harnesses waft by beneath him, but above the other humans. Saw people in an apartment on the other side of the gallery wave. He waved back, almost without thinking, and smelled perfumes and the scent of cooking. He looked up at the roof, which was not glass, but some other more perfectly transparent material. He supposed he could have asked his little pen terminal to find out exactly what it was, but he had not bothered. And he listened in vain for any sound of the storm swirling and blowing outside.
They do love their little insulated existence, don't they?
Yes, they do. He remembered a gallery, not so dissimilar to this, in Shonesta on Chell. It was before they had married, about a year after they had met. They had been walking hand in hand, and had stopped to look in a jeweler's window. He had gazed in casually enough at all the finery, and wondered if he might buy something for her. Then he'd heard her making this little noise, a sort of appreciative but barely audible, At first he'd assumed she was making the noise for his amusement. It had taken him a few moments to realize that not only was she not doing that, but she was not aware that she was making the noise at all. He realized this, and suddenly felt as though his heart would burst with joy and love. He turned, swept her into his arms, and hugged her, laughing at the surprised, confused, blinkingly happy look on her face.
Quill?
Sorry, yes. Somebody laughed on the gallery floor below. A high, throaty, female laugh, unrestrained and pure. He heard it echo round the hard surfaces of the closed-in street, remembering a place where there were no echoes at all. They had got drunk the night before they left. Estodian Viskile, with his extended entourage, including the bulky white-furred UAO, and he. He had to be helped from his bed the next morning by a laughing UAO. A drenching under a cold shower just about brought him round. Then he was taken straight to the VTOL, then to the field with the suborbital, then to Equator Launch City, where a commercial flight hoisted them to a small orbiter. A demilled ex-Navy privateer was waiting. They had left the system, headed for deep space, before his hangover started to abate, and he realized that he had been selected as the one to do whatever it was he had to do, and remembered what had happened the night before. They were in an old mess hall, decorated in an antique style, with the heads of various prey animals adorning three of the walls. The fourth wall of glass doors opened onto a narrow terrace, which looked out to sea. There was a warm wind blowing, and the doors were all opened, bringing the smell of the ocean into the bar. Two blinded, invisible servants, dressed in white trousers and jackets, attended them, bringing the various strengths of fermented and distilled liquors a traditional drinking binge required. The food was sparse and salty, again as dictated by tradition. Toasts were proposed, drinking games indulged in, and UAO and another of the party, who seemed nearly as well built as the white-furred male, balanced their way along the wall of the terrace from one end to the other, with a 200-meter drop to one side. The other male went first, UAO went one better by stopping halfway along and downing a cup of spirit. Quillan drank the minimum required, wondering quite what it was all in aid of, and suspecting that even this apparent celebration was part of a test. He tried not to be too much of a wet blanket, and joined in several of the drinking games with a forced heartiness he thought must easily be seen through. The night wore on. Gradually, people went off to their curl pads. After a while, only Viskile, UAO, and he were left, served by the larger of the two invisibles, a male even bulkier than UAO, who maneuvered his way amongst the tables with surprising adroitness, his green-banded head swinging this way and that, and his white clothes making him look like a ghost in the dim light. UAO tripped him up a couple of times, on the second occasion causing him to drop a tray of glasses. When this happened, UAO put his head back and laughed loudly. Viskile looked on, like the indulgent parent of a spoiled child. The big servant apologized and felt his way to the bar to bring back a dustpan and broom. UAO sank another cup of spirit and watched the servant lift a table out of the way, one-handed. He challenged him to an arm-wrestling contest. The invisible declined, so UAO ordered him to take part, which eventually he did, and won. UAL was left panting with exertion. The big invisible put his jacket back on, inclined his green-banded head, and resumed his duties. Quillan was slumped in his curl seat, watching events with one eye closed. UAL did not look happy that the servant had won the contest. He drank some more. Estodian Viskile, who did not seem very drunk at all, asked Quillan some questions about his wife, his military career, his family, and his beliefs. Quillan remembered trying not to appear evasive. UAO watched the big invisible go about his duties, his white-furred body looking tensed and coiled. "They might find the ship yet, Quill," the Estodian told him. "There may still be wreckage. The culture, their consciences, helping us look for the lost ships, it might turn up yet. Not her, of course. She is quite lost. The gone before say there is no sign, no hint of her soul-keeper having worked. But we might yet find the ship, and know more of what happened." "It doesn't matter," he said. "She's dead. That's all that matters. Nothing else. I don't care about anything else." "Not even your own survival after death, Quillan?" the Estodian asked. "That least of all. I don't want to survive. I want to die. I want to be as she is. No more. Nothing more. Ever again." The Estodian nodded silently, his eyelids drooping, a small smile playing across his face. He glanced at UAO. Quillan looked too. The white-furred male had quietly changed seats. He waited until the big invisible was approaching, then stood up suddenly in his path. The servant collided with him, spilling three cups of spirit over UAL's waistcoat.
"You clumsy fuck! Can't you see where you're going?"
"I'm sorry, sir. I didn't know you'd moved." The servant offered UAL a cloth from his waistband. UAL knocked it away.
"I don't want your rag," he screamed. "I said, can't you see where you're going?"
He picked at the lower edge of the green band covering the other male's eyes. The big invisible flinched instinctively, pulling back. UAL had hooked a leg behind him. He stumbled and fell, and UAL went down with him in a flurry of crashing glasses and tumbling chairs. UAL staggered to his feet and jerked the big male after him.
"Attack me, would you? Attack me, would you?" he yelled.
He had pulled the servant's jacket down across his shoulders and over his arms so that he was half helpless, though the servant anyway did not seem to be putting up any fight. He stood impassively as UAO screamed at him. Quillan didn't like this. He looked at Viskile, but the Estodian was looking on tolerantly. Quillan pushed himself up from the table they were curled at,
The Estodien put a hand on his arm, but he pulled it away.
Traitor!
UAL bellowed at the invisible.
Spy!
He pulled the servant round and pushed him this way and that. The big male crashed into tables and chairs, staggering and nearly falling, unable to save himself with his trapped arms, each time using what leverage he had from his midlimb to fend off the unseen obstacles. Quillen started to make his way round the table. He tripped over a chair and had to fall across the table to avoid hitting the floor. UAL was spinning and pushing the invisible, trying to disorient him or make him dizzy as well as get him to fall over.
Right, he shouted in the servant's ear. I'm taking you to the cells.
Quillen pushed himself away from the table. UAL held the servant before him and started marching not to the double doors which led from the bar, but towards the terrace doors. The servant went uncomplainingly at first, then must have regained his sense of direction, or maybe just smelled or heard the sea and felt the open air on his fur, because he pushed back and started to say something in protest. Quillen was trying to get in front of UAL and the invisible, to intercept them. He was a few meters to the side now, feeling his way round the tables and chairs. UAL reached up with one hand, pulled the green eyeband down, so that for an instant Quillen could see the invisible's two empty sockets, and forced it over the servant's mouth. Then he whipped the other male's legs from under him, and while he was still trying to stagger back to his feet, ran him out across the terrace to the wall, and upended the invisible over the top and into the night. He stood there, breathing heavily, as Quillen came stumbling up to his side. They both looked over. There was a dim, white ruff of surf round the base of the sea stack. After a moment, Quillen could see the pale shape of the tiny falling figure outlined against the dark sea. After a moment more, the faint sound of a scream floated up to them. The white figure joined the surf with no visible splash, and the scream stopped a few moments later.
Clumsy, UAL said.
He wiped some spittle from around his mouth. He smiled at Quillen, then looked troubled and shook his head.
Tragic, he said. High spirits.
He put one hand on Quillen's shoulder.
High jinks, eh?
He reached out and brought Quillen into a hug, pressing him hard into his chest. Quillen tried to push away, but the other male was too strong. They swayed, close to the wall and the drop. The other male's lips were at his ear.
Do you think he wanted to die, Quill?
Hmm?
Quillen?
Hmm?
Do you think he wanted to die? Do you?
I don't know, Quillen mumbled, finally being allowed to use his midlimb to push himself away. He stood looking up at the white-furred male. He felt more sober now. He was half terrified, half careless. I know you killed him, he said, and immediately thought that he might die too now. He thought about taking up the classical defensive position, but didn't. UAL smiled and looked back at Viskile, who still sat where he had been throughout.
Tragic accident,
UAL said. The Estodien spread his hands. UAL held on to the wall to stop himself swaying and waved at Quillen.
Tragic accident.
Quillen felt suddenly dizzy and sat down. The view started to disappear at the edges.
Leaving us too?
He heard UAL inquire. Then nothing till the morning.
You chose me, then.
You chose yourself, Major. He and Viskile sat in the privateer's lounge area. Along with UAL, they were the only people aboard. The ship had its own AI, albeit an uncommunicative one. Viskile claimed not to know the craft's orders or its destination. Quillen drank slowly, a restorative laced with anti-hangover chemicals. It was working,
though it might have worked more quickly. And what Yuweil did to the blinded invisible? Viskile shrugged. What happened was unfortunate. These accidents happen when people drink freely. It was murder, Estonienne. That would be impossible to prove, Major. Personally, I was, like the unfortunate concerned, unsighted at the time. He smiled. Then the smile faded. Besides, Major, I think you'll find called to arms UAL has a certain latitude in such matters. He reached out and patted Quillen's hand. You must not concern yourself with the unhappy incident any further. Quillen spent a lot of time in the ship's gym. UAL did too, though they exchanged few words. Quillen had little he wanted to say to the other male, and UAL didn't seem to care. They worked and hauled and pulled and ran and sweated and panted and dust-bathed and showered alongside each other, but barely acknowledged the other's presence. UAL wore earplugs and a visor, and sometimes laughed as he exercised, or made growling, appreciative noises. Quillen ignored him. He was brushing the dust bath off one day when a bead of sweat dropped from his face and spotted in the dust like a globule of dirty mercury rolling into the hollow by his feet. They had mated once in a dust bath, on their honeymoon. A droplet of her sweet sweat had fallen into the grey fines just so, rolling with a fluid, silky grace down the soft indentation they had created. He was suddenly aware he had made a keening, moaning noise. He looked out at UAL in the main body of the gym, hoping he would not have heard, but the white-furred male had taken his plugs and visor off and was looking at him, grinning. The privateer rendezvoused with something after 5 days' travel. The ship went very quiet and moved oddly, as though it was on solid ground, but being slid around from side to side. There were thudding noises, then hisses, then most of the remaining noise of the craft died. Quillen sat in his little cabin and tried accessing the exterior views on his screens. Nothing. He tried the navigation information, but that had been closed off too. He had never before lamented the fact that ships had no windows or portholes. He found Viskile on the ship's small and elegantly spare bridge, taking a data clip from the craft's manual controls and slipping it into his robes. The few data screens still live on the bridge winked out. "Estonienne?" Quillen asked. "Major," Viskile said. He patted Quillen on the elbow. "We are hitching a ride." He held up a hand as Quillen opened his mouth to ask where to. "It's best if you don't ask with whom or to where, Major, because I'm not able to tell you." He smiled. "Just pretend we're still underway, using our own power. That's easiest. You needn't worry. We're very secure in here." "Very secure indeed." He touched midlimb to midlimb. "See you at dinner." Another 20 days passed. He became even fitter. He studied ancient histories of the Involveds. Then one day he woke, and the ship was suddenly loud about him. He turned on the cabin screen and saw space ahead. The navigation screens were still unavailable, but he looked all about the ship's exterior views through the different sensors and viewing angles, and didn't recognize anything, until he saw a fuzzy Y shape, and knew they were somewhere on the outskirts of the galaxy, near the clouds. Whatever had brought them here in only 20 days must be much faster than their own ships. He wondered about that. The privateer craft was held in a bubble of vacuum within a vast blue-green space. A wobbling limb of atmosphere, 3 meters in diameter, flowed slowly out to meet with their outer airlock. On the far side of the tube floated something like a small airship.
The air was briefly cold as they walked through, turning gradually warmer as they approached the airship. The atmosphere felt thick. Underneath their feet, the tunnel of air seemed as pliantly firm as wood. He carried his own modest luggage. Yuayol toted two immense kit bags as though they were purses, and Viskile was followed by a civilian drone carrying his bags. The airship was about 40 meters long, a single giant ellipsoid in dark purple, its smooth-looking envelope of skin lined with long yellow streaks of frill, which rippled slowly in the warm air like the mantle of a fish. The tube led the three Chelgrians to a small gondola slung underneath the vessel. The gondola looked like something grown rather than constructed, like the hollowed-out husk of an immense fruit. It appeared to have no windows until they climbed aboard, making the ship tip gently, but gauzy panels let in light and made the smooth interior glow with a pastel green light. It held them comfortably. The tube of air dissipated behind them as the gondola's door irised shut. Yuayol popped his earplugs in and put on his visor, sitting back, seemingly oblivious. Viskile sat with his silvery stave planted between his feet, the round top under his chin, gazing ahead through one of the gauzy windows. Quillen had only the vaguest idea where he was. He had seen the gigantic, slowly revolving, elongated, eight-shaped object ahead of them for several hours before they'd rendezvoused. The privateer ship had closed very slowly, seemingly on emergency thrust alone, and the thing, the world, as he was now starting to think of it, having come to a rough estimate of its size, had just kept getting bigger and bigger and filling more and more of the view ahead, yet without betraying any detail. Finally, one of the body's lobes had blotted out the view of the other, and it was as though they were approaching an immense planet of glowing blue-green water. What looked like five small suns were visible, revolving with the vast shape, though they seemed too small to be stars. Their positioning implied there would be another two, hidden behind the world. As they got very close, matching rotational speed with the world, and coming near enough to see the forming indentation they were heading for, with the tiny purple dot immediately behind it, Quillen saw what looked like layers of clouds, just hinted at, inside. "What is this place?" Quillen said, not trying to keep the wonder and awe out of his voice. "They call them air spheres," Viskile said. He looked warily pleased and not especially impressed. "This is a rotating twin lobe example. Its name is the Oskendari airsphere." The airship dipped, diving still deeper into the thick air. They passed through one level of thin clouds, like islands floating on an invisible sea. The airship wobbled as it went through the layer. Quillen craned his neck to see the clouds, lit from underneath by a sun far beneath them. He experienced a sudden sense of disorientation. Below, something appearing out of the haze caught his eye. A vast shape, just one shade darker than the blueness all around. As the airship approached, he saw the immense shadow the shape cast, stretching upwards into the haze. Again, something like vertigo struck him. He had been given a visor too. He put it on and magnified the view. The blue shape disappeared in a shimmer of heat. He took the visor off and used his naked eyes. "A dirigible behemothor," Viskile said. Yuayol, suddenly back with them, took off his visor and shifted over to Quillen's side of the gondola to look, imbalancing the airship for a moment. The shape below looked a little like a flattened and more complicated version of the craft they were in. Smaller shapes, some like other airships, some winged, flew lazily about it.
Quillan watched the smaller features of the creature emerge as they dropped down towards it. The behemothor's envelope skin was blue and purple, and it too possessed long lines of pale yellow-green frills which rippled along its length, seemingly propelling it. Giant fins protruded vertically and laterally, topped with long bulbous protrusions, like the wingtip fuel tanks of ancient aircraft. Across its summit line, and along its sides, great scalloped dark red ridges ran, like three enormous encasing spines. Other protrusions, bulbs and hummocks, covered its top and sides, producing a generally symmetrical effect that only broke down at a more detailed level. As they drew still closer, Quillan had to press himself against the frame of the little airship's gondola window to see both ends of the giant below them. The creature must be 5 kilometers long, perhaps more. "This is one of their domains," the Estodienne went on. "They have 7 or 8 others distributed round the outskirts of the galaxy. No one is entirely sure quite how many there are. The behemothors are as big as mountains and as old as the hills. They are sentient, allegedly, the remnant of a species or civilization which sublimed more than 1 billion years ago, though again only by repute. This one is called the Sansonin. It is in the power of those who are our allies in this matter." Quillan looked inquiringly at the older male. Viskile, still hunched over, holding his glittering stave, made a shrugging motion. "You'll meet them, or their representatives, Major, but you won't know who they are." Quillan nodded and went back to looking out the window. He considered asking why they had come to this place, but thought better of it. "How long will we be here, Estodienne?" he asked instead. "For a while," Viskile said, smiling. He watched Quillan's face for a moment, then said, "Perhaps 2 or 3 moons, Major. We won't be alone. There are already Chelgrians here. A group of about 20 monks of the Abramyle Order. They inhabit the temple ship Soulhaven, which is inside the creature. Well, most of it is. As I understand it, only the fuselage and life support units of the temple ship are actually present. The vessel had to leave its drive units behind, somewhere outside, in space." He waved one hand. "The behemothors are sensitive to force field technologies, we're told." The superior of the temple ship was tall and elegant, and dressed in a graceful interpretation of the Order's simple robes. He met them on a broad landing platform at the rear of what looked like a giant, gnarled, hollowed-out fruit, stuck onto the behemothor's skin. They stepped from the airship. "Estodienne Viskile."
"Estodienne Quetta."
Viskile made the introductions. Quetta bowed fractionally to Uweol and Quillan. "This way," he said, indicating a cleft in the behemothor's skin. 80 meters along a gently sloping tunnel, floored with something like soft wood, they came to a giant ribbed chamber, whose atmosphere was oppressively humid and suffused with a vaguely charnel smell. The temple ship Soulhaven was a dark cylinder, 90 meters in length and 30 across, taking up about half of the damp, warm chamber. It appeared to be tethered by vines to the chamber's walls, and what looked like creepers had grown over much of its hull. Quillan had, over the years of his soldiering, become used to encountering makeshift camps, temporary command posts, recently requisitioned command HQs, and so on. Some part of him took in the feel of the place, the extemporized organization, the mix of clutter and orderliness, and decided that the Soulhaven had been here for about a month. A pair of large drones, each the shape of 2 fat cones set base to base, floated up to them in the dimness, humming gently. Viskile and Quetta both bowed.
The two floating machines tipped briefly towards them.
"You are Quillen," said one.
He could not tell which. "Yes," he said. Both machines floated very close to him. He felt the fur around his face stand on end, and smelled something he could not identify. A breeze blew round his feet.
"Quillen, mission, great service, here, to prepare, test, later, to die, afraid."
He was aware that he had flinched backwards and had almost taken a step away. There had been no sound, just the words ringing in his head. Was he being spoken to by the gone before?
"Afraid?" the voice said in his head once more.
"No," he said.
"Not afraid. Not of death." "Correct. Death, nothing."
The two machines withdrew to where they had hovered before.
"Welcome all. Soon prepare."
Quillen sensed both Viskile and Ueol rock back as if caught in a sudden gust of wind, though the other Estorienne, Quetta, did not budge. The two machines made the tipping motion again. Apparently, they were dismissed. They returned down the tunnel to the outside.
This ends Side 1 of Cassette 7.